There's a place in New York where you can walk through the actual front doors of the world's most famous recording studio, Abbey Road. Through those doors, past the Beatles, Pink Floyd, Radiohead, and countless other rock giants. Where can you find those doors? At the Hard Rock Cafe Times Square. The Abbey Road doors and thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock Cafes, Hard Rock Casinos, and Hard Rock Hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's coolest conversations time in Little Steven's Underground Garage, presented by Hard Rock. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. My guest today is a longtime friend of the Underground Garage, Greg Cartwright from The Raining Sound. They've got a new live album out on Merge Records called Memphis in June, and Greg also collaborated with the Black Keys on several songs for their new album Dropout Boogie, including our recent coolest song in the world, Wild Child. We'll hear some of that now, followed by my chat with Greg Cartwright on your coolest conversations presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage. This is the Mighty Manfred, and with me today is singer, songwriter, musician, and producer Greg Cartwright. He's a creative force behind The Raining Sound, and prior to that, he was in seminal groups like The Oblivions and The Compulsive Gamblers. His side projects include producing roles that have led him to work with the likes of the Shangri-La's lead singer Mary Wise, as well as having stints in The Deadly Snakes, The Detroit Cobras, and The Parting Gifts. Greg is also one of the songwriters who contributed to this week's coolest song in the world, Wild Child from the Black Keys. Greg, how are you?
I'm doing good, Manfred. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. I'm excited to get a chance to chat with you again. You know, we spoke, it was like 2 years ago, right, as the pandemic thing was, you know, really kind of in its high swing. Since then, you and the family, have you managed to stay healthy?
Yeah, we really have. I got the COVID, but it was a pretty mild case, so I consider myself very lucky. And otherwise, we've been pretty good.
When you had it, was that, I know there was earlier this year, it was you had some tour dates scheduled for out west and they were canceled. Was that when you had it, or did you have it a couple years ago? Or
I got it in February, and we had booked a tour for early March, first week of March.
Yeah.
And I think I got it, several other musicians that I knew got it. And I just really saw the handwriting on the wall. And it's only proven to be more true as the months have gone by. In the last couple months, a lot of tours have been canceled. And mostly what I feared was just the domino effect of, you know, five older traveling musicians getting out there. One of us gets sick, you get in a hotel room to quarantine. And by the time, you know, that person's stint is done, the next person gets it. And the next thing you know, you're supposed to be, you know, 8,000 miles away in another town. And the whole thing is just a lost cause. So, yeah, I had to cancel those dates just out of fear of the Omicron, which was really surging at that
time. Well, you know, this is something that's come up with a lot of folks I've spoken to. Even the guys, the Huda Gurus were talking about, you know, wanting to come to the U.S., but there's just no way we're going to do that. And you have somebody get sick, and then
then they got to be quarantined. And then that's the end of the tour, and that they don't really make a lot of money.
Yeah. There's, I mean, for bands like us and I'm sure for them as well, there's we do it because we want to see the fans, and the fans want to see us. There's not a whole lot of money in it. So it's mainly something that we do because we love it. And with a labor of love, you can't stand to lose, 4 months of earnings, you know?
Right. Well, the new Black Keys album, let's talk about that. This Dropout Boogie comes out today, Lucky Friday, the 13th release. And on it, they reached out to several artists to collaborate, including Billy Gibbons of ZZ Top, this producer-songwriter, Angelo Petraglia, and then yourself. And I'm thinking, well, didn't Dan Auerbach have something to do with the parting guests with you and Coco Haymes of the Etts?
And he did.
So is that how you guys met, or how did you wind up working with the Black Keys?
Well, I met Dan and Patrick both. It was probably around 2005 or 2006. They were really just starting to get a lot of traction and really building their following at that time. And they were starting to play bigger and bigger venues. And they reached out to me when they played Asheville, North Carolina, which is where I was living at the time. And we hung out after the show and discovered that we had a lot of mutual friends and mutual love of similar kinds of music. And we stayed friends and kept in touch. And a few years later, when I was working on the Parting Gifts record in Nashville with Coco and Jim and Dave Amels, we started working on that record, and Dan happened to come through town. He was looking to move to Nashville and was house hunting and had his whole family with him. And they stopped by the studio, and I said, "Hey, do you want to play on some cuts?" And he said, "Sure." And so in an afternoon, he sat in and played guitar on some tracks. And later he produced a Raining Sound album at his Easy Eye studio. It was one of the first things that he did in the studio once it got up and running, right before he did the Dr. John album there.
Oh, yeah. So I'm familiar with the Dr. John record, which I think sounds great.
I think it's fantastic. I think it's such a good record.
And what Raining Sound album did he produce of yours?
It is called Abdication for Your Love is the name of it. And it was a promotional release thing that was a limited release. And then when we signed to Merge, they licensed it for an official release. Okay. So it came out for the first time about 3 years ago, the first real release of it. And that was, I think it was 9 songs on that LP, and more than half of it was done with Dan. I think we did 7 songs with Dan.
Cool. Well, I read that Dan and you mentioned Patrick. We talk about Patrick Carney, the other half of the Black Keys. That they had worked up initial versions of the songs on the new album, and then they reached out to people to collaborate. I'm like, is that right?
Yeah, I think the way that they come up with their material is they like to get together and just jam. Yeah. And see what comes of that. And they each probably bring melodic ideas, rhythm patterns, stuff like that to the table. And then they see what happens when they get together and jam on these riffs. And they had a couple of ideas and invited me to come and hang out. And so we mainly just hung out in the kitchen of the studio and strummed guitars. And we, at that point, I already knew what the chords were and what the riffs and the licks were. So then we just worked on what the lyrics would be, what maybe some turnarounds would be. So we worked on the lyrics, but we did actually alter some of the riffs and stuff a little bit too, to fit some of the lyrical ideas that we were writing. And I knew kind of already that Dan and Patrick like to work in that kind of immediate way of kind of being in the moment of inspiration. But it really knocked my socks off when we finished up the lyrics and they literally walked into the other room and just started recording the ideas that we had been working on, including rearranging some of the instrumentation and stuff to be what they wanted for how the song was going to be now that we had finished it. And it was pretty, you know, immediate. I mean, it was kind of amazing to me that they could work that way. Cause you think about people on a, you know, on that level, with that amount of success and that amount of attention on their singles when they come out, right, probably spending a lot of time laboring over something. And that wasn't really what was happening at all. They were pretty much still, in some ways, just a rock band, you know, they still just enjoyed playing off the dynamic that they had together. And that was really kind of inspiring to see.
So the song Wild Child, that was the song they approached you with, or did you guys go over the songs and thought, oh, this is the one I want to work on?
They approached me with four songs and we worked on all four of them, and three of them made the record. One of them, there were several songs that out of the body of work of demos and things that they had been working on for the record, you know, some things didn't make it, but three made it. One was the lead single, Wild Child. One was the one that just came out last week, It Ain't Over. Right. And then I think there's another one that we wrote together that's on the album.
Another thing I saw was this, it's from Patrick. Carney had a quote saying, the cool thing with Greg is that he wants to approach stuff with a story in mind. There's a plot almost. So when they came, they approached you with this, I guess they had a rough outline of lyrics.
They didn't really have any lyrical idea, but Pat had a great lyrical a melody for the lyric that I really liked. And as soon as he laid that out for me, then I could immediately get into the lyric process with them. But that was a big help. If Pat had not had an idea, because it's a two chord song. Yeah. And the thing with two chords is, you know, there's not a lot of limitations melodically because there's not a lot of chord changes and stuff. So you can go a lot of different ways. And it really helped to kind of get the ball rolling that Patrick already had an idea for how he wanted the melody to go. And for me, a lot of times with lyrics, it's true. I like a storyline, and I would love, if it's possible, not always, sometimes being more abstract is the way to go. To deliver the feeling that you want. But a lot of times I do like a little bit of a story. And so I tend to start that way with some kind of storyline or a plot line for the song.
Well, when we spoke about your songwriting before, you had mentioned that up until you had met Esther, your wife, that your songwriting revolved around sort of creating characters, or as you put it, I thought this was really great. You said putting on costumes.
True.
And I thought, oh, cool way to describe that. And then you mentioned that after meeting her, you started writing more about, you know, experiences you had had or just about yourself. So how much of Wild Child is from your experiences? Have you ever dealt with either of these characters, the stranger with the twisted smile or?
For sure. Definitely. And it was fun because the initial idea for the lyric was that I think we were kind of leaning into this idea, like the guy who you encounter at the beginning of the song, he's kind of shifty and yeah, you don't know what he's up to, and maybe he's telling you what you want to hear, but it's a lie. And then the idea is that kind of turns in the second verse, and he thinks that she's kind of an easy target, but actually she's just as complicated as he is. And I think that tends to be the truth in relationships.
Yeah. Well, in that sense, you know, maybe those wild children deserved each other, you know, in this song.
they do. Well, I mean, you've got to, yeah, they are at least for sure they're attracted to each other.
Did you play on the recording?
No playing on the recording for me. I watched from the control room while they were working on the song, but I didn't actually take part.
So how often have you written a song, sort of collaborated with an artist, whoever's going to record it, and not been present on the recording? Is that strange at all?
It's definitely a new experience for me. Yeah, I've never experienced that before. Usually I'm somehow either I'm playing guitar or I'm singing or I'm playing some other instrument or I'm involved in production. So just to write the lyrics and then just sit back and watch the rest unfold was totally new experience for me.
If you were to record that song yourself, would you change anything about the arrangement?
I hadn't thought about that, but I think that it is a perfect song for the Black Keys. And I think especially right now, it really is exactly what their fans wanted them to make. And they somehow instinctively knew that as we were finishing the song in the studio, they both were saying, I think this is the lead single. This feels right. And I think in that sense, I wouldn't consider recording the song because it's so them and it's a Black Keys song all the way. And I think that is the fun thing about getting invited to write with other people and collaborate with other people is that it takes you outside of something you would do yourself for your own band or your own songwriting. To be allowed into someone else's process allows you to experiment with where they're headed and trying to help them hit the bullseye that they're looking for. And to me, that's a really fascinating process that I'm really lucky over the pandemic. Dan invited me to write on several sessions. I wrote for this Black Keys record, but that was the culmination of other sessions that we did together with other artists that he produced. And I got to say, I love the process. I was a little afraid at first and it got easier.
What were some of the other artists that you were working with Dan on?
Marcus King, who's a young blues player from South Carolina. Fantastic, really an amazing singer and guitar player. And his new record, which I think comes out in a couple months on American, Dan and I worked on a bunch of songs for that album. We worked on some songs with Early James, who's an artist on Easy Eye as well. And I came in, the first thing that we kind of worked on together was the Shannon and the Clams record. And that was kind of in a pre-production role where I didn't actually write anything. We considered maybe that once I got there, we would write songs, but all we really did was take the songs that they had brought in as demos and just try to help form them into exactly what the songs would be once they hit record. Because that is the way when you're recording, the way that Dan records, pre-production is really important, just kind of knowing exactly what's going to happen when you hit record so that you can catch it all. And then, you try to keep whatever manipulation there's going to be to the recording to a minimum after the fact. So it's important to know what the structure of the song is going to be, exactly what the dynamics are going to be. And so that first thing that I worked on was the Shannon and the Clams. And that's what we did, was just pre-production stuff. But I think it made Dan realize that I was kind of laser focused in that way about putting the song together. And to me, writing songs is a lot of it is like a big puzzle. And I really enjoy the puzzle, like figuring out how it's all going to fit together and work the right way.
Well, you use that analogy of putting a puzzle together, and I wish I was clever enough to remember what the exact lyric is to your track, Let's Do It Again. Something about working on a puzzle for two, but...
Oh, yeah, a jigsaw puzzle for two.
that's my transition. That's my segue into talking about the Raining Sound's most recent studio album, last year's A Little More Time With, out on Merge Records. And you did that with... members of the band's original sort of the Memphis lineup. Can you remind us about how you wound up working with those guys again, as opposed to the usual band?
Yeah, so there's a great crew of players that all live in New York. Dave, of course, lives in New Jersey, but most of those guys are up on the East Coast. And that's who I've been working with for the last 8 years or so. But the pandemic came along and that wasn't going to be a possibility. But I was having the pandemic really was a weird thing when it got first got started. No planes flying, no cars driving, everybody's in their house. And I just started walking a lot. And then I started journaling a lot. And out of that just came a bunch of songs. And I immediately wanted to get to work on the songs, but I knew I had to find a studio that would let me come in and do it, that would be willing to shut the studio down to other groups and just let me work. And I did. Scott Bomar from Memphis, an old friend and owner of Electrophonic Studios. He's actually about to, he's moved into Phillips Studio in Memphis now, which is really cool. Yeah.
Okay. Well, so, we've spoken with Scott before. He produced the Don Bryant album.
Great record.
A killer record that we were playing here in the Underground Garage and got a chance to speak with Scott Zone.
He's a fantastic engineer, great bass player, but he let us do it there. And yeah, I initially thought that I would try to get with the guys in New York, but I realized after talking to Dave that was not going to be a possibility.
Yeah.
And then I thought, the more I thought about it, the more I thought it might be a nice way to wrap the Raining Sound up completely. And because I'd been thinking that I would like to try some other projects, do another Parting Gifts record, maybe try some other things. And I felt like the Raining Sound had had a really good run. This would be a great way to wrap it up and do one last record with the Memphis lineup. And so that's what we did. Luckily, they were all available and into it. You know, that was at that time getting someone to be okay with working on a project in person, all of us in a room together. Yeah. was a tricky thing, and something that had to be a calculated risk that you were willing to take. But we did try to keep it limited, and it just worked out great. It was one of my favorite records I think I've ever made.
Well, you know, you can feel there's a lot of exuberance on there, certain tracks especially that I mentioned. Let's Do It Again, and I'll mention it again because it just sounds so fun.
Yeah, no,
and of course, there's this thematic theme of using these original players. So was that song written before you got back with those guys, or did it come out of working with them again?
When I got there, I had already written all the songs.
Okay,
and I sent them all the material in advance, but there were still dynamics to work out. But I tried to give them the most detailed idea of how the songs would go. There were still, you know, drum parts and bass lines to work out, but it worked out pretty fast. And luckily they could all make themselves available to rehearse before I got there. And once I got there, we took, I think, 4 days to rehearse. Then we had 1 week to record the record and 1 week to mix it. So I tried to keep it pretty tight, but the way that we recorded it, there wasn't a lot you could do anyway. It was 1-inch 8-track tape machine. So, you know, it was pretty much a live record with the exception of one or two overdubs of a guitar or a tambourine or something like that. It's a pretty limited recording, but dynamically, I mean, it sounds really full.
Well, why did you, what is it about the Sandy Shaw song that resonated with you? Because you covered this tune of hers, I Don't Need That Kind of Lovin', or at least she did that song.
There are several people did it. I'm not sure. That's a good question. I'm not sure who wrote it or who did it first. I learned it from Adam Faith, who is also another British pop singer. And most of his stuff is pretty poppy. But I guess there was like a small window of time where he had a band called the Roulettes or something that were more of a club rock band. And that track feels like a rock song, more of like a teen rocker.
Yeah.
And it came out in the States on Capitol. And I found it one day thrifting for records in the early 90s and just loved it. And so we used to play it in the band with Raining Sound when we first got together. It was a staple of our live shows.
Yeah.
But we just, for whatever reason, we never got around to recording it. Or if we did record it, I didn't feel like it measured up to what we had been doing with it live. And so I knew that if we were going to get together to make one more record, we had to get that one in the can.
Well, I had looked up the songwriter on that, and so he did other songs for Sandy Shaw, and so I'm like, again, I wasn't sure who else had recorded it. You used the word, I mean, this is again in the weeds here, but I was just wondering, the real cool song, "Oh Christine," and often your lyrics have a poetic flair to them, but you actually use the word "the" in "Oh Christine," and I was just wondering what a, you know, it says archaic word and kind of conjures up, at least to me, sort of this medieval romance.
I do like romantic poetry.
Yeah,
I really do like it a lot, and sometimes I have to edit myself because I go too far into it.
Yeah,
and I don't want to make people feel like they're listening to some Elizabethan something or another. I feel like everything in good measure, you know.
Yeah.
So I think it's okay to have some of that in there because I think it does add a kind of a romantic quality to certain ideas because it's already a romantic idea,
right?
What's going on in the song. But it kind of, yeah, just kind of adds to it a little bit.
So you do a song with Coco from the Etts, Coco Hames, that's "Just Say When." And we mentioned her playing with you in The Parting Gifts. What about y'all's working relationship? You've done a number of things, right? When did you meet and what all of you guys done together?
Well, I met her when she was in the Etts. And her former husband, Jim, was the bass player. Okay. And they approached me to do, and this actually is another connection with Dan. They had asked me to produce a record of the Etts. Mm-hmm. And they had done a single. Dan Auerbach had produced a single for them. And I think maybe even he suggested that they get me to do the rest of the record. He couldn't commit to doing an entire record. So then I produced the rest of the album and Dan did the single. And that was a great time making that record. And it was a thing though, when I got there, they had some similar to the thing with Shannon and the Clams. I got there, they had lots of ideas for songs. Mm-hmm. And they were almost complete, but they weren't quite finished. And so we spent about a week on pre-production, just really tightening the songs up. And maybe I would write a bridge or I would help them with whatever the songs needed to be fully realized. And then we recorded them. And that was the beginning of our working relationship. And then we worked on The Parting Gifts together. And since then, Coco has married our friend Bob, and they have moved out to Tucson recently. And Bob actually wrote the Replacements book that came out a few years ago, which was a really fun read. I don't know if you read that. But
no, I didn't. But this is how weird the world is. I actually met them. And I'm just now remembering that somehow my ex-wife has a connection to Coco. And
yes.
And in fact, so this was at a party that my daughter, when she was very young, she was in the same preschool as this couple who my ex-wife knew from I guess San Francisco. And so they have this little pool party, and this couple's daughter, incidentally, also has a nickname of Coco. But in any event, they were standing, and the book hadn't come out yet, and we were standing out on this deck, and we were introduced. So that is a weird, though.
It's a small world.
You know, it's a small world. The rock and roll world, as you know, is even smaller.
Exactly.
If you know, and meaning no harm to all these extraneous people, but if they could just not get on the roads, you know, everything could, we could be a lot more efficient, you know, going back and forth. You know what I mean? Yeah. I think it would go quicker, causing all this. There's the people just getting in the way, you know.
Yeah.
But now, if they all came to shows, that would be, That would be pretty good.
But I'm hoping that here in the next, with it before the year is out, I'm hoping to record another Parting Gifts record with Coco. So that's something that's on the horizon. We're just texting this morning, sending demos back and forth and trying to figure out a time we could get together and write and finish up some of these tracks and get a list, like a song list together of exactly which songs we'd like to record. The other thing is I'm starting tomorrow, I start recording a new project that I just started working on in the last, I would say I've been working on it for about a month and a half. Scott McMicken and I have started a band with our friends Evan and Kevin. It's a four piece and it's called The Hypos. And Scott was sang and played guitar in Dr. Dog. And he just moved to Asheville a couple months ago. And as soon as he moved here, we started writing together and working on this project. So I've got a lot of things on my plate, actually. It's really funny that it seems like for almost the entire time I've been in Asheville, which is 20 years now, I rarely ever had like a working band in Asheville. And so now, of course, I bought a house in Memphis in December. And our plan was that once our daughter was off to college, that we would maybe sell the Asheville house and move back to Memphis. But, here comes the snag. You know, like someone that I would love to work with has moved to town and we've started a band. So we'll see how it goes.
So this whole pandemic thing, that nothing has slowed down with Greg Cartwright, you know, it's like,
if anything, it seems to have picked up momentum, right? Picked up somehow. I don't know how or why, but I think definitely the thing with Dan calling me to work on these songwriting sessions was the beginning of a resurgence for me with my songwriting. The Raining Sound album was a lot of songs came at once. And around that same time, Dan called me to do these songwriting sessions. So I think there's a connection there as well, but it has just led to me being more prolific with the writing, also pushing myself to write more, but also having all these collaborations has really helped me think about songs outside of my own process or outside of the way that I would normally approach it, and trying to collaborate and bring other people's process into it. And that's been really interesting for me.
And also I have to take a moment here to thank you. So one of these things that a minor thing that you worked on, you were able to contributed a guitar track to a Woggle song, and I really appreciate that.
Oh, it was an honor. Yeah, it was a real honor to be a part of it. I mean, it's like I said, I think I sent you a text saying it's an institution, and you said
that's yes. You could go ahead and say what my reply was.
a mental institution or something, yes. Like that, I think was your response.
yeah. Well, it's, you know, and that's all said with so much love, positive love. That's a positive.
Yeah, no, I love the Woggles. And that's seeing the Woggles early on was a big inspiration for me as a musician and for the Oblivions. And it was just, you guys were torchbearers for the whole rock and roll scene in the 80s.
Well, thanks. That means a lot coming from you, because those groups, you know, the Oblivions certainly, and Compulsive Gamblers, it was all the same. That was a great era. And you mentioned Scott Bowmore earlier, and he was in this band Impala.
Yep.
And there was really this great rock and roll scene going on to that time.
Estrus was home to us all. Yeah.
Right. Dave Kreider up there in Bellingham, Washington. Really cool.
Thanks, Dave.
Label Estrus Records. So with regarding the Woggle song, we won't get a chance to mix it until June, and then it should come out on an album in 2023.
Wow. how crazy is it now that the process, how long it takes from the moment you write the song until you record it, until it is eventually released, maybe well over a year.
That is completely crazy, isn't it? You know, but I mean, if we were, so we're on Little Steven's label, and that's great. But with any of these labels, of course, they have other artists, and then there becomes like, you know, getting in a queue to get
right.
something out. So, I mean, if that wasn't the case, of course, we could put it out far earlier. But I guess, again, in our case,
and even though, but even. Yeah, I mean, even, I mean, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I mean, who knows? Because even without a label, if you just make your own thing, you might even be, the queue might be even longer, because a lot of these labels have an outstanding relationship with certain pressing plants that they have these queues established. I've talked to people who are not on labels who are self-releasing things, and the wait is even longer, because then you have to stand outside of that queue. You know, so I mean, that's even, I mean, and that's, of course, when we were making our own EPs in the 80s and the 90s and LPs and stuff, there was not this wait time because no, there was
right. In fact, everything was imploding around that time.
Right. Exactly. You
know, but that's exactly what I was going to bring up. If we were, you know, doing things on our own, then this wait time with the press, we would want to do vinyl records, and then the wait time would still be about a year.
Yeah.
You know, but talking about getting things out, you just had a live album that came out on April the 23rd and then on Record Store Day. It's called Memphis in June. And these were shows you recorded in June of last year.
Yes. And yeah, we got as soon as we got them done, we did some shows that were, it was actually just one main show at Harbortown down by the Mississippi River in Memphis. We did that show and we knew that at that time, the thing was because people couldn't tour, people were live streaming concerts. So we did a live stream of this concert. And since it was going to be live streamed, I had to make sure the audio was really good. And we hired a friend of ours to engineer it. And the audio came out really great. And once I was done with it and I handed it off to Merge, they were like, well, we got to find some outlet for this because this sounds really, really good. And so we planned to make it work for a Record Store Day. And that just seemed like the perfect, I mean, once again, like almost a year later, it comes out. But I'm just really glad that we could get in the queue and get it put out. I think like I said, I kind of intended for a little more time to be the last hurrah for the Memphis lineup and for the band in general. But I think this live recording of some of the old songs and some of the new songs is a really great way to cap it off.
And so when you did that show, the stream, were you in the middle of those sessions or had those sessions just finished?
They had finished. So the album had just come out, I think maybe a week before this show. Okay. So this show was like to celebrate the release, play a lot of the new songs live, but also to stream. Unfortunately, when we did that, the streaming phenomena was almost done. People were starting to go out to live shows again. And so when we finally released the edited version of the show to stream, people watched it, but it wasn't getting as much attention as shows that had been streamed maybe 6 months prior.
Right.
Because people were like, hey, the masks are coming off. Let's go out and see something in person.
Which I saw, talking about seeing things in person, I saw online a listing for you guys playing at the Orange Peel in Asheville. This is like the beginning of June, June the 1st. And that's one of several shows you'll be doing with Superchunk. We've mentioned these West Coast dates. Are those shows ever going to be rescheduled? Are there other U.S.? Because I know you're going over to Europe and doing a bunch of stuff in Europe starting July.
Yes.
Are you going to do other stuff in the States before the end of the year?
I don't think so. The only other two things that we're going to do are there's a show at the Memphis Shell, the Overton Park Shell, the Levitt Shell, it's called. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of a historic spot in Memphis inside a big park, and it's a, you know, an oval band shell. It's really beautiful. Elvis played there.
Yeah,
they used to have the blues festivals there. Really cool place to play. And so we're going to play there. We're going to do one other show at the Rail Garden in Memphis, and then these shows with Superchunk, and that's it. That's pretty much it. And then the European tour.
A European tour, and that seems to, that's several weeks.
It's 2.5 weeks. Yeah. So that's several shows, and we haven't been to Europe in a very long time. So, and we very lucky to have a big fan base there. So we really want to go over there and give them a good show before we call it a day.
And this lineup, that's the Dave Amos lineup that's going.
No, this will be the Memphis group.
It is the Memphis guys.
It is the Memphis group. Everybody except, unfortunately, Jeremy, our bass player, he got off work, but as I'm sure you experienced and you already know about, everybody is so shorthanded right now. They initially said that he could have the time off, and then they said, actually, we can't we can't spare you right now. So he wasn't able to do it. And we had our friend Seth Moody is going to step up and play bass for those shows.
Well, good luck with all that. I want to talk about one more track that's on A Little More Time with the Raining Sound. And it was, you know, we can only play like one other track as we're going out, and it was hard to, you know, pick one. But the one I want to do is You Don't Know What You're Missing. And the reason for that is, especially is, again, this is going back to lyrics, but you've got this terrific turn of phrase in there. Just tell me what you need, and baby, I'll listen. If you don't know what you want, then you don't know what you're missing. Which that's just killer phrasing there.
Oh, thanks, Bamford.
Yeah, how'd you pull that one out of the ether?
I really don't. I only know that I was strumming the chords over and over again and trying different combinations. And when I landed on that one, I knew I had something that I could build a whole song around. So I got that chorus. And once I got that chorus, then I knew what the song was about. And then I could start building the verses and stuff.
So when you landed on that, did you just think gold? You know?
Well, I felt really satisfied. And yeah, that is the thing that drives me to keep writing all the time, is that level of satisfaction that I can't get from anything else in life, to be honest. Then when I complete that thought and I think this actually says something so perfectly in this little small sentence.
Yeah.
I know that if I release it, other people will hear it and it will connect to them. That is just, it is. It's the most satisfying thing I can do with my time.
I really love also that tune overall has got this, at least in my frame of reference, sort of Bobby Fuller-esqueness to it, or Sonny Curtis kind of.
Oh man, that's a huge compliment. Sonny Curtis, such a big influence on me as a songwriter. That in particular, that Crickets album that they put out after Buddy Holly passed away is, in my mind, the best Crickets record. And that's not a put down of Buddy Holly. I love Buddy Holly, but he was heading more in a pop direction with more akin to maybe a Teresa Brewer record or something. Is kind of where it seemed like they were. Coral was kind of definitely grooming him to be more of a pop star, right, than a rockabilly guy, and he wrote great pop songs. But when they did that Crickets record, and Sonny Curtis took over as mostly the main songwriter with what is it? Jerry Allison's the other guy.
Yeah, the drummer. Yeah,
and that album, you can tell that Bobby Fuller adored that album as well.
Oh, absolutely! He pulled a lot of stuff off.
He covered almost half of it by the time he passed away. It's such a great record. Absolutely. But yeah, that is a big influence on me. And it's funny, Jimmy Stallings, aka JJ Light, who played bass with Sir Douglas Quintet and had his own solo records and stuff, as a friend of mine. And when I sent him the record, he said, "Wow, there's some songs on here that really remind me of Bobby Fuller." I just took that as a total feather in my cap.
And you should. I like that feather. I want to see you adorned with it like a peacock head.
Exactly. You know? Hey, now before you, I don't know if you can edit this later or whatever, but I have to tell you, because I don't know if I've told you. Esther and I bought a house in Memphis in December.
Yeah.
And it belonged to Marshall Grant, who was the stand-up bass player from Johnny Cash and the Tennessee Two.
Okay.
And he bought it in 52. And he and Luther Perkins, who they were mechanics together, they started having like a picking party there every Saturday. Wives would come over and guys would come over and they would pick. They had this wood-lined room. And eventually Johnny Cash, who was a relative of one of their coworkers, moved to town and they invited him over. And that the picking party eventually kind of morphed into the trio. And they were all three guitar players. And Marshall said, "Oh, I'll buy a bass, because if we're gonna keep doing this, somebody's gotta step away from the guitar and play a different instrument."
Right.
But So that house that we bought was where they had all of their original rehearsals, and they kind of became a band. And I just got back yesterday, but I'd been in Memphis for 10 days, just kind of working on the house and trying to get it ready and stuff. But it's just been, it blows my mind to sit in that room and strum a guitar. I was almost, actually we owned the house for months before I ever did it, because I was kind of scared to sing and play in that room.
So that room, like the, was it like wood paneled?
Yes.
Yeah. And so it's been, it hadn't been, like nobody's been messing with the panel, right? I mean, it does it seem
I bought the house from Marshall's son.
Yeah.
Randy. So he's owned the house the whole time. Marshall passed away about 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And his wife, Etta, just passed away last year. And Randy, everything had to go through probate. And, you know, they owned lots of properties and stuff. But Marshall would never sell that house. And he would never update it or paint it or anything. So it's like a time capsule inside. Everything, the kitchen's still like green Formica countertops. And
oh, great.
It's amazing. I mean, it's, you know, like if you like mid-century house, I mean, it's like, it's exactly what you want. And just the fact that all those people hung out there, Johnny Powers, Carl Perkins, like, cause they would have big parties over there once the ball got rolling with the 200 series at Sun. And yeah, I mean, it's, you know, his son was telling me about people that would come over and hang out at the house and stuff. I mean, it's just really, it's, I can't believe that we own that house.
Well, great. Congratulations on the house. And when is our first picking party?
As soon as you can make it down.
Well, all right.
Summer.
You know, you have to be careful, because I will follow up on this stuff, you know.
Be happy to have you.
Greg, I want to thank you again so much for being my guest today on our Coolest Conversations.
Thank you so much. It's an honor and a pleasure to talk to you anytime.
And always a joy speaking with you. Here is The Raining Sound with You Don't Know What You're Missing off their album A Little More Time With in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Nobody knows what's going on in your mind. But day by day, your love will change with no one inside. Just tell me what you need and maybe I'll listen. But if you don't know what you want, then you don't know what you're missing.
That was The Raining Sound. You Don't Know What You're Missing from last year's album A Little More Time With, out on Merge Records. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to Greg Cartwright for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast. For the next Coolest Conversations, I'll speak with UK rocker Ginger Wildheart. He'll have a new single out on May the 20th, backed by The Sinners. We'll find out all about it on your next Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
With no stars in the sky, no hope to anchor my mind.
As a child, Otha Ellis Bates McDaniel taught himself to play guitar, but he never found one he liked, so he built his own. Soon after, his rectangular-shaped axe with an old TV dial for a volume knob could be heard on radios everywhere as he launched the beat heard round the world. He was Bo Diddley. His handmade guitar is at the Hard Rock Cafe, Times Square. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history are at Hard Rock Cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com. Don't let it slide, baby, diamond ring.